Hello and welcome to the Beyond Shakespeare podcast and this new series of the Fantasy Production Meeting, where we build the productions we want to see as a down payment to the future. I'm Robert in Lavenham.
I'm Liza in London.
I'm Alexandra, currently in the UK.
And I'm Sarah in Wonderland.
And we are the Fantasy Production Team, and this is our meeting. Today we're looking at The Old Wives' Tale by George Peel. George wrote this play in the early 1590s for the Queen's Men. Queen's Men, premier touring acting troupe of the 1580s and 90s, formed of all the best talents. They were the Dirty Dozen of their age, a supergroup a la ABBA, Crosby, Stills and Nash, and Busted. But pish-mish to all this history stuff, we're only interested in how we might want to produce this play today. And in our fantasy production room each month, we're going to pitch our ideas for a future production, in part to inspire and build an actual show, but also for a cheap laugh. If you're inspired by our ideas or would like to keep us in cheese, then you can support our work generally on Patreon, patreon.com/beyondshakespeare, where you can hear the uncut version of this episode. You also get the episode early, and you can even watch the video version. You can watch what we're doing with our hands now. There's a host of other patron-only content available as well. Early access stuff available too. But if you can't give something every month, or you want to be very super specific about what you want to give to and what you want to see come out of your money, and if you really want this play, specifically this play, to happen, then there will be a specific PayPal link in the show notes labelled with this play. That money will be put aside for the creation of some content to help make a production come into being, either some initial artwork or workshopping, or, you know, depending on how much money comes in, maybe even the full production itself. Maybe not the productions we pitch, but maybe something on that lines. And you can also, hopefully, we're going to produce some specific merchandise to go with this play that you can buy to help make that production come about, and also to fill that desperate hole in your soul that you can't fill. But that's enough introductory blather. Let's get down to business. We've got a series of questions to answer about our various pitches, and you can suggest questions if you like. And the first question that we've got down is very simple. What is the play about? Because many of you won't have watched our various videos on The Old Wives' Tale on YouTube. So here's a brief recap of the action. And the lucky recapper this month is Sarah. So, Sarah, The Old Wives' Tale, what's it all about?
Well, I'm glad you asked. The thing to know about this play is that it all takes place in a fairy tale world. And as with many fairy tales, we begin the story with a hero who has lost his way in the dark woods. Or actually, in this case, we have three heroes who have lost their way in the dark woods, and their names are Antic, Frolic, and Fantastic. We learn early on that they are servants to an unnamed young master who has gone off with his fair lady. And quite how this has led to the three of them getting lost in the woods is anyone's guess, frankly. I have no clue. But anyway, that's what's happened. So the three of them are stumbling around in the dark woods, bemoaning their fate, and they meet a man called Clunch, a kindly blacksmith. And he invites them back to his cottage, and they meet his wife there, Madge. Madge is a very good hostess, so she offers them a piece of cheese and a pudding of her own making. And then after everyone's eaten and had a bit of a song, Antic, who seems to be the ringleader of the trio, suggests that they while away the rest of the evening with a story, a Merry Winter's Tale. Madge takes up the challenge, but before she begins, she says that her husband, Clunch, has to go to bed early because he's got to get up in the morning. And because she's staying up to tell the story, someone else is going to have to go to bed with him instead. Antic volunteers himself for this unnatural rest. So he and Clunch pop off to bed together, and Madge settles down to tell Frolic and Fantastic the story of an evil conjurer called Sacripant. And this evil conjurer has, in the previous scene, before the play starts, he turned himself into a dragon and kidnapped a king's daughter, who's called Delia. And Delia's family are obviously distraught about this. And so her two brothers have been sent to go on a quest to recover her. And this is the point where Madge starts her story. And at this point, it all starts to get a bit weird because as she talks about them, the two brothers actually appear in Madge's cottage. And her story starts to magically come to life before the audience's eyes. There then unfolds a frankly bonkers fairy tale, which I will do my best to recap. It's mainly about Sacripant's dastardly doings and the consequences of that. So he captures the nice but dim brothers very quickly. They put up no threat whatsoever. He puts them to work and he casts a spell over Delia so that she doesn't recognise them. We also learn that he's been busy cursing this other chap too, called Arrestus, who had a lovely wife that Sacripant took a fancy to. So to get him out of the way, Sacripant has cursed him so that he's an old man during the day and a bear at night. But then for some reason, rather than making off with the lovely wife, who's called Vinalia, he curses her too and she runs mad. Meanwhile, in his manifestation as an old man, Orestes seems to have developed prophetic powers. So he tells a local farmer to send his daughters to seek their fortunes at a magic well. Now, these two girls are polar opposites. One is called Xantippa, and she is beautiful but bad-tempered. And the other one is called Salanta, and she is sweet but ugly. When they get to the magic well, Xantippa goes to draw water from it first. And as soon as she gets there, this giant brazen head rises out of the well and tells her to stroke him if she wants a reward. Xantippa is having none of this because she's a sensible girl, but her sister Salanta apparently has no qualms about stroking giant heads. And she is consequently rewarded with a golden shower of money. It turns out to be a good day for them because they meet these two completely random dudes called Juanabango and Booby, and they've also been cursed by the evil magician Sacripant. Juanabango is deaf, so he gets together with Xantippa, who's the beautiful but snarky sister, and Booby has been struck blind, so he hooks up with Salanta, who's the nice but ugly one. Back at Sacripant's castle, meanwhile, Eumenides has turned up, and he is just this noble knight who, through an encounter with a churchwarden and a sexton that I'm not even going to begin to talk about, frankly, has been befriended by a ghost called Jack. So the pair of them, human and ghost, turn up at Sacripant's castle to defeat him, but they can't, because Sacripant's power and life are preserved in a magic lamp that can only be broken by one who is neither a maid, nor a wife, nor a widow. So all seems lost. But then, at the 11th hour, Vinalia, the mad wife, remember her, turns up and being married to Orestes, it means she's neither a maid nor a widow, but she's not technically a wife either because at the time he happens to be a bear. So she breaks the lamp, Sacripant shrivels up into his timely end, his spells are all broken. There's then a slight weirdness with Delia Eumenides and the ghost of Jack right at the end, but that all gets sorted out really quickly and everyone lives happily after and... Madge wakes up. It's now morning. She's apparently dreamt the whole thing and she puts this down to eating a late snack of bread and cheese. So she offers breakfast to Fantastic and Frolic and all is well. But there's still no sight of Antic or Clunch. I don't know what's happened to them. Presumably they're still in bed. Anyway, on that entirely logical note, the play ends.
I'd love to say that was all deliberately timed, but that would be a lie. Technically, I said, Sarah, you know, you had 2 minutes. That wasn't 2 minutes.
That was not two minutes.
But I wasn't going to be mean. Did she miss anything out?
Well, the whole turning into a bear situation came relatively late into the story. But yes, I think there's a whole backstory for Orestes, who is the old man, who is the young man turned into an old man and also into a bear at different times. It's complicated.
Yeah, it's the thing is, when trying to explain the story, at what order do you put the events of the story? Because the story, there's so much of it is backstory that that people just sort of complain about in awkward ways.
I would say this sounds more complicated than it plays, because so much of the play is fairy tale based that to a lot of the audience, once they see the thing that keys them into the fairy tale that's being told at the moment, the backstory will become sort of intuitive.
Yeah, it has fairy tale logic, which when you're describing it, makes no sense at all. But when you're actually within the world of the story, it all just happens.
In a sense, the story is there's an old wife who tells a tale, but she's not necessarily very good at telling the tale. So the tale gets a bit confused. And so you get all these fairy tales mashed into one.
She's also asleep for most of it, to be fair to Madge.
I don't know if she is. At the end, I think she just ends the story. I don't think it's a dream.
She does say
that depends on the I think it's going to I think that's going to be one we decide upon. I think we can discuss whether the play technically says it or not, or whether our productions say it or not.
Oh yeah.
The play definitely says that she's gone to sleep.
Okay.
Well, yes. And Fantastic does say, what, Gamma, asleep?
That is fair. That is fair.
Yeah.
But then she wakes up and talks.
Yeah, she wakes up and it's morning and it's like, oh.
Yeah, and they have breakfast. Well,
they have breakfast.
The thing I feel that we're missing about the plot is...
The plot?
Yeah.
Yeah, so stuff happens. And I think the important thing to say here is it's all really fun. It's all really fun. If we sound like we're mocking, we're not mocking this at all. All of these details are fabulous. They're wonderful. There's a bear, a man. We don't know if he is technically presented as a bear. I suspect at times we should. I think we should probably do that.
I think it's always good to have a bear.
Yeah, it's silly and it's deliberately silly, and therefore we are allowed to. We're not.
And
mocking,
I think there are very good reasons for the silliness as well, which I will come on to later.
Ooh, lovely. So I think that's question one, as unhelpfully but brilliantly recapped there. It is a play where you kind of have to be there. You kind of have to be there. And it's sort of a paper exercise that we were just doing there. Question two, which I'm leading, is broadly speaking, which budget, venue, media? So broadly speaking, in our fantasy production, where are each of us placing our production? How are we producing it? What kind of budget do we want for it? So I'm going to start with my short concept of what I would like to do. Now, I should point out before I talk about my concept, the original plan this year was we were going to do an audio version of this. And I actually went through two versions of what we were going to do. We were just going to do a straightforward audio adaptation, some people in studio recording some stuff, mixing it all together and putting it out. Then I sort of went, you know what, it is so fun. It needs an audience response. So I thought, well, we're going to hire a theatre and we're going to record the audio with a live audience. And that's what we were supposed to be doing at the end of this month. Unfortunately, a global pandemic occurred. And so that's been sort of kicked into the long grass. So I didn't want to just pitch that. So what I want to pitch is slightly different. So yes, what I want to do is a live theatre experience as a pretext to record the audio for the podcast. But what I want to do is I want to take it to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and I want to get into one of the big venues, and the entire cast would be made up of stand-up comedians and people in light entertainment who would be in Edinburgh for the festival doing a set. We'd say that a percentage of it goes to charity so that we can punch above our weight and get as many moderately famous people in, which means the whole thing sells out and we don't have to do any publicity.
It's a very good point when you're going to Edinburgh.
Exactly. And and so the idea is we'd be in a relatively large theatre space. Everybody would be mic'd up. It would be script in hand. And we would also have projection as part of the experience. So it would be more theatrical than just a recording of a live audio. I quite like the idea of having a live artist doing sketches and images as part of that. We'd have some prepped, but I like the idea of live sketches because these characters are all so sketchable. They're so visual. The budget wouldn't be huge in terms of the actual creating the theatrical space elements. Most of those would probably be in-house stuff. But ultimately, even though we'd say a lot of money's going to charity, we'd have to massage the egos and the pay packets of lots of moderately famous people as well. So, that's where all the money would probably go. Charity and ego.
But
so,
am I right in understanding, Rob, that in your production, depending on the ticket that people have paid for and or the medium and time that they enjoy the production in, they might hear/see more and different things, additional layers?
Yes, there'll be a theatrical experience and an audio experience, and they would be slightly different. There would be room, and this is more for a later question, of allowing those professional comedians to find additional material, some of which would be visual, some of which might be explicitly written and text-based, but we'll come to that in a later question. Who wants to leap in with their production? Who wants to leap in next? Alexandra, what tell us of your production?
My imaginary production would also be staged It would also be sort of dually layered, but in a different way. My production is bilingual. So it would be both in English and in sign language. I've noticed that there are lots of opportunities in the text for playing around with who has heard what or who is communicating what to whom. There's a lot of repetition. There's a lot of, did you not hear that? So I think there are gags that could be kind of discovered in rehearsal in that way. It would be a theatrical production. It would be live performance, and it could be done quite low budget and very tourable, so that you could take it, for instance, to schools or to community venues or sort of small scale spaces and audiences.
So a live theatre show that is an ongoing proposition, as opposed to something that's more one-off and something that is playing around with the different ideas. I'm liking that, you know, whereas mine's just cheap laughs and light entertainment. You're doing something that actually might improve the world, whereas my production probably just makes it worse. Liza, tell us of your production.
Well, I want to do this on Zoom because it's a play that involves a lot of magic, which requires special effects that in a theater are difficult and or expensive, and on Zoom are very practical. Because this isn't like high art, it can be vandalized. While still preserving the spirit of the thing and the things that are good and fun about the original thing, which is why we're doing it. How I want to vandalize it is a framing device, that I want this to be a Zoom production of a Zoom production, talking about the limitations of a Zoom production. So this play has songs in it. More than one person cannot sing together on Zoom.
So we've tried this, haven't we? It's a disaster every time.
We've tried and failed.
So you have to actually lip sync for your life. And so the three characters we meet first have a little song together to cheer themselves up. And then they meet Madge and Clunch and they're like, well, we'll sing for our supper. And they sing another song to them. And I think by the time they sing the second song, they've realized that because they can't do this for real and they have to lip sync, they can make it awesome. So it is full-on Drag Race lip-syncing for your life, or with possibly some pre-recorded bits involving a disco ball, possibly.
We can get disco balls. Yeah, I think that's that's very doable.
Sacripant is an actor who trained at RADA and is furious at having to do this on Zoom, thinks they're too good for this. There are a couple of people who just signed up to this to have fun and have no idea what's going on. But there are also in-universe gags, like Madge's cooking is terrible. If you're lost in the woods and you're hungry, the only reason you would turn down a piece of cheese and a homemade pudding is if they are god-awful and the cheese is moldy and the pudding is, like, blackened and grotesque.
Yeah, when they offer the food, I just see it as, literally, it just goes onto the table with a thunk. It's just literally solid. And he's just going, yeah, we'll pass.
And various people's Zoom productions have made me aware of what is possible if you go next level with your production. If you're not just doing a Zoom reading, but you're doing something rehearsed, ideally from memory, with tech, with movement, with stuff. So for things like the heads in the well, on Zoom, we are all heads in the well. And it would be very easy to have a head in a Zoom window above the person at the well. And to have them comb the gold and to have like some kind of tech wizardry where the gold falls into your window from above. So that's my idea, is fun and chaotic, humorous randomness, except it's actually scripted randomness, so it turns out funny, on Zoom.
Excellent. Sarah, your pitch.
Well, if this was the real world, I think I would want to be in Liza's production, frankly, because that just sounds amazing, particularly the limp syncing and the disco ball. I'm highly in favour of all of that. However, as this is not reality and you asked me for my fantasy production, I want to go full Hollywood with this, honestly, because it's a fairy tale and I want a shitload of CGI. I want to be able to, you know, just create this amazing world and draw everybody into it. I've got my ideal cast who are a mixture of, you know, Hollywood celebs and then, you know, stalwart British actors. And I just, you know, I want to see Orestes turn into a bear. And I want to see that head rise out of the most fantastic CGI'd well. And yeah, so I just want big budget, big sort of all those production values that you get in a, you know, like a sort of Avengers movie, like a Marvel film, so that we can have this great big epic, you know, supernatural magical story on screen, and then we can subvert all those sort of tropes and stereotypes that you get in those sorts of big fantasy action films.
So if I'm getting this right, Sarah's production is the full-on CGI kind of proper technical effects big screen version, whereas Liza's production is the same thing except the small screen kind of, well, computer screen version with the homemade CGI special effects.
Lysis is the version we could actually do.
Well, yeah, I mean, the difference fundamentally here is what we're talking about, the difference between modern green screening and 1970s CSO. Technically exactly the same thing, but one is 1970s Doctor Who and another is good. Anyway, we need to rapidly move forward into the next question. Next question is Liza, I think. So obviously there are quite a few characters, but the question is, who are the characters? And so the extension of that question is, who are the major characters you'd like to talk about? Any points of interest about the characters? And also fantasy casting. Who do we want to see playing these parts? Liza first, to talk about what you want to do with characters.
Antic, Frolic and Fantastic are basically clowns, and they can double other parts as well. I see them as quite young people who don't quite have a handle on how to live life yet. Clunch and Madge, something about the way Clunch is written makes me hear Yorkshire in my head, but that's the only directive I have about him. Madge at least has to be a good storyteller, because she's the one who draws you in. Sacripant, it goes without saying that any of these can be any ethnicity and any ability, and, you know, I'm all about inclusion, even though I'm a white American person, so I would by default be a white person in charge of a thing, which isn't necessarily the best thing to be in these times, but I can only work from where I am. So yeah, I'm completely up for casting in a conscious and aware way of what our profession looks like and should be. So yeah, Sacripant has to be this Rada-trained snotball, basically. The two brothers may or may not double Antic and Fantastic. No, wait, they're on at the same time. They can't. But I think Clunch can double the bear guy. So we need one fairly large, fairly bluff actor. Lampriscus, the misogynist dad, he's one scene. And we also have the one scene of the burial of poor Jack. One scene, but very well-drawn people that only appear for one scene. So, you know, lots of doubling, lots of multi-rolling, some puppetry, because we're doing it on Zoom and we can do, and puppetry works really well on Zoom. There have to be two extremely clueless supernumeraries, and one person who's really good at movement, who will be Vanilia, who just basically dances on and is mad and dances off. But she does it twice, and it has to be really memorable.
Yes, because she doesn't actually technically have any dialogue.
We would address. There also have to be some songs which I would honestly probably pre-record using a cappella. There are some random harvest men who turn up and sing, where if you don't cut them, and I'd quite like to not cut them, songs are nice.
More importantly, what are the harvest men up to? Because, you know, these are sexy harvest men, and they come on the second time with sexy ladies too. Exactly. Or more importantly, they're having sexy times.
Never cut the sexy harvest men is the first rule of Old Wives' Tale. If I had the budget to go all singing and all dancing, I completely would, and I would pay everyone at fair rates above equity minimum.
Excellent. Yay. Now, Sarah, you've got a budget of millions, so you can cast anybody. And, you know, what would happen to these characters in a mainstream American film? I mean, that's one of your problems there, is maybe that's going to change who some of these characters end up being.
Well, I don't know. Personally, what I would plan to do would be to take all the Hollywood money, attach a couple of big names to it so that they would give me all the Hollywood money, and then just basically subvert the whole thing. So I was thinking we'd have a mixture of, in my version, we'd have a mixture of, like, yeah, Hollywood stars and then sort of stalwart comic actors. And also, because it's a fairy tale, and because I have spent the last 20 years reading Angela Carter, and I'm very into my fairy tale subversions and my gender swapping, I'm thinking that the tale within the tale, you could just cross-cast that. So I've got my dream cast list here, starting with the big names. I've got Idris Elba as Delia, Lily James as Eumenides, Judy Dench as Orestes, because I feel she could pull off the whole bear ancient prophet thing, you know. Beyonce is definitely my lead harvestman, you know, with a whole load of backing dancers there. I've got Chris Pine as Xantippe, because, you know, he's the handsome one. And then I've got Toby Jones as Solanta, bless him. This is the only bit of like non-cross-casting I've done in the fairy tale, because I couldn't imagine anyone else doing it. I've got Brian Blessed as the Brazen Head.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely fair enough. Yeah.
Who else? And then for the rest of the cast, I've got sort of stalwart British comedians. So I've got Bill Bailey as Vanalia running on at the end, breaking the lamp. I've got Shirley Henderson as Sacripant, because she's got that amazing voice, and I think she'd be so good as the evil sorcerer. Miranda Hart as Juana Bango, because obviously. And Susan Carman as her sidekick Booby. And then I've got Sally Phillips and Laura Carmichael doing a double as the Nice But Dim brothers, because, you know, they can both do terribly posh very well, posh but clueless. So, yes. And then within the actual, like, the framing story, I could only just think of Barbara Windsor as Madge. So this is not cross-cast. I've sort of gone down a carry-on theme for the framing story. So I've got Barbara Windsor as Madge. I've got Kenneth Williams, God rest his soul, as Clunch. And then for
digitally
Antic,
recreated from
digitally
beyond the grave.
Digitally recreated, yes. And then for Antic, Frolic and Fantastic, I've got basically all three of them recreated as different personas of Frankie Howard.
Right. Okay. Yeah. If we're going to spend Hollywood money, that's what we should be doing,
well.
is digitally recreating as many dead comedians as we can.
Specifically carry on comedians.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a perfectly legitimate thing.
It's better use of Hollywood money than usually goes on. So
yeah. I quite agree on all those fronts. Now, you, of course, and Liza can afford to a degree to not do any doubling, whereas Alexandra may not. I don't know. You're talking about a school's touring budget here. I'm suspecting you might need to do some more extreme doubling. Any characters leaping out at you?
Well, so my entire thing is actually revolving around doubling. If I remember correctly, the text seems to be constructed in a way that you only ever have five people on stage at the same time. So I would like to put it together as a cast of six, as many of them as possible being bilingual, but not everyone needs to be able to speak and not everyone needs to be able to sign. So there are ways of arranging the doubling in such a way that some people are only voiced characters and some people are only signed characters. Because I would like to shamelessly steal a wonderful idea from a Grey Eye production I witnessed, where the person who was doing the translation into sign language on the side of the stage was also doing the translation into voice for the characters who were signing. So rather than that, but stealing that idea, what I want to do is have someone else on stage always be the other half of whatever it is that we are hearing or seeing, justified through the story. So it's someone, let us say, expressing themselves in sign language and the person they are conversing with speaking out the words that they are being given, etc. A whole bunch of variations on that and of ways of playing with it and abusing it, such as doing something with Orestes and Vanilia, where Orestes has this whole speech where he describes the backstory he has with Vanilia, and then we just see her run across the stage. So in my version, no one signs his speech, and then Vanilia comes on and signs the backstory, and no one speaks it, and so on. So what I would want to do in terms of casting is ideally, of course, cast as many of the six performers, one of whom has to do some puppetry. Our sixth performer presents the dog at the beginning and potentially the bear and so on. But yes, to arrange the casting in such a way that it offers opportunities, as many opportunities as possible, to either sign language-based performers or bilingual sign and speech performers, and then fills up the numbers with voice only if that's not achievable with six people who can do the other one or both.
Excellent. And once again, my concept is so derivative because all I need to do to cast mine is just watch some episodes of Taskmaster on Channel 4. And because all I need to do is pick up people from modern day light entertainment. Clunch, the joy of Clunch. I mean, thing is, Clunch is on stage for so short a time, but he has such a wonderfully expressive name. He is just absolutely amazing. And you're right, he can double as pretty much anybody else in the play because he disappears. He drags off this young ingenue at the beginning. Nobody else has taken us up on the one Muppet rule. I'm definitely seeing a guest appearance by the Gonzo the Great as Sacripant. I feel that's very important.
Rob, you know it has to be Count Von Count.
Oh, no, definitely Gonzo. Definitely Gonzo. He can play anything.
It's true, he's
very versatile. So I basically just pluck out random people from whoever's in Edinburgh that year is the easy one. But yeah, I just want to continue the joy of Clunch. I'm just going to keep saying that.
That could be like a whole other play or another play within the play, The Joy of Clunch.
The Joy of Clunch. I have to say the idea of Brian Blessed as the big talking head is absolute. That's the image you want, really, isn't it? Even if he's not literally there, you want to mould your giant head
to look like Brian Blessed.
And I think that's absolutely gorgeous.
And to sound like him, and in my production, sign as representatively of that as well.
Yes.
Absolutely. I think we're all agreed on that front. And now it's time to chill out for a little while as Sarah shows you how to make a cocktail designed to complement this wonderful play.
Legal disclaimer.
We accept no liability as to how this drink affects your internal organs or views on the nature of reality. All recipes are followed at the listener's own risk. Don't have nightmares.
And now, over to Sarah and Cocktail Minute.
So, yes, I like to invent cocktails, and because this is such a colourful play, I decided to invent a cocktail for it, and it's called Madge's Dream. It's invented from things that Madge sort of might have in her garden, like rhubarb and damson and roses, although she would also need a gin distillery in her garden, but I'm guessing Madge might possibly have one of those. The flavour profile is slightly sweet, fruity and floral. I've deliberately gone for a slightly sweeter taste because it's to pair nicely with a piece of strong cheese. So you know you want that balance. So you will need, if you're following along at home, you will need one of these to measure your ingredients with, and you need to start with 40 milliliters of rose liqueur. Oh, a bit exotic, very nice, very fragrant. And then you will need 30 milliliters of rhubarb gin. This is the good stuff. Then you will need 20 milliliters of damson gin. This is not the good stuff, actually. This is rough as old boots, but it's good because it kind of cuts through the sweetness of the rose liqueur. And then you will need the juice of. So then you put all that in your cocktail shaker with a couple of ice cubes, give it a shake over ice, strain it into a martini glass, garnish it with a cocktail cherry. I bet Madge has got a cocktail cherry tree in her garden too. Then you serve and you get this lovely pink drink. If you are a patron, you will see that I have actually dyed my hair to match it, and it tastes, oh yeah, it tastes like, yeah, never mind. Cheers.
And if you are a patron, you can taste it too.
The ingredients list and preparation instructions will be made available after this, if Sarah survives long enough. All that remains for me on this moment to say is soupy twist. A full ingredients and instruction list should be available via the show notes. I say should, I don't know if it will. So, we're going on to We're going on to the next question, whatever it is. Yes, question number four. This is quite a quick fire one. Alexandra is going to lead this one. What is your play, your production, going to be about? What's it about? High concepts are allowed. Low concepts are also allowed. So, Alexandra, what's it about?
What the hell is going on? Mm. And now we have, what is this about? What are we trying to achieve? So I think I very much agree with Lyle's point about this being a play that gives us some very positive messages. One of them is this idea that generosity and kindness are good in and of themselves and are kind of things that will lead to positivity, if not necessarily exact reward. Of course, in the play they do. And I also think there's a lot of it about acceptance, about accepting one's lot in life, about accepting one's limitations. You know, the two sisters who are described in very negative terms by their father, both actually are just, you know, humans who have flaws and positive features as well. And they end up matched with humans who have positive features and flaws. So also accepting, you know, of other people. That is very much what my production would be focusing on. Thankfully and helpfully, without this being dictated as a message at the end. So what I think is wonderful is you could take this to schools or present it to young audiences with some trimmings of really questionable content and have a very positive message, a very positive thing that it's about, that never gets hammered.
The other thing I find really interesting about this is that Sacripant is this character who loves control. You know, he wants to control everything. He learns his magic purely in order to, you know, control his life, basically, and control everyone else's life according to the way he wants them to be. He likes Vanalia. He turns her husband into a bear. Juana Bango and Booby get in his way. They are struck deaf and blind. The brothers are immediately, you know, cursed and put to work. He's like the big cheese, isn't he? He's the big CEO who has to micromanage every aspect of life and control everybody and make everyone's life shit just so that he can feel good about himself, basically. He plans everything down to the point where, you know, he knows he's invincible because he can only be defeated by someone who is neither a wife, a maid, or a widow. And yet then Vanalia, the mad woman, you know, the supposed victim, rushes on at the end and, you know, knocks his light out, quite literally. You know, there is always, fairy tales always find a way to undercut the status quo, and anarchy rises up and subversions happen. And in this play in particular, because Sacripant is such a control feat, it really plays with that. And I love that. And this is actually partly why I want to do a big budget Hollywood version, because I would like to use this plot to kind of infiltrate that whole system and just then mess with all those big action film tropes and undercut them and poke fun at them a little bit. Because, yeah, kindness and freedom and not being a complete narcissist, not trying to control everyone else, you know, that is what the themes of the play seem to be for me. And yeah, I think we need a bit of that on the big screen.
So much of what I think is important about this play has been said, just, you know, that the theme is random acts of kindness are rewarded. And if you're terrible to people, it does come back to bite you, is the moral of the story. But in addition to a moral, the point is fun. We live in a time where very little is fun. We need fun.
Oh, we're starved. We need fun.
We need joy. So even, you know, and as a director, you have to be careful with that mandate, because if you enforce whimsy, that's, you know, all the fun goes out of it. But, you know, if you're the sort of director who will cast the right people and then trust them to find things so that your artists then have fun while you're doing it, I think that has great potential. Also, you know, as a Zoom production, the internet loves fun. The internet loves random, fun, chaotic stuff. So, yeah, fun.
Yes, I'd like to add to that, that if the internet should be interested in some fun and entirely unfaked visual gags and indeed use of props, there is a production that we have, I say we, I wasn't involved in it, in second reading of this, that involves such things as bears. And I recall not what other great excitements that is on the internet.
Yes, we have looked at this play twice in our exploring sessions, once stopping and starting and once straight through. Rapidly moving on to question five, which I feel is probably quite a short one. Sarah, do you have any specific rehearsal process in mind for this kind of play?
Yeah, well, the thing that occurred to me is setting aside the whole Hollywood fantasy for a moment, coming back to reality. When I'm directing a play, one exercise that I quite often get my casts to do is to imagine their character's backstory. So things like where were they born? What was their childhood like? What were the major influences? You know, what were those defining moments of their life so far previous to this? And, you know, how have their memories and experiences shaped the character that they are? It's a really good exercise for, especially for minor characters. The actors who are playing the minor characters, if they don't have many lines, it really helps to give them a sort of sense of stage presence. And it's also a really fun one to do. And I think this exercise would be particularly good for the framing characters, especially Antic, Frolic and Fantastic, because let's face it, I have no clue who they are. And I think it'd be quite good if they did know who they were before they went on stage. I mean, they're wandering around in the woods. How did they get there? Why are they there? Who is this mysterious master and the fair lady who we never hear of again? I mean, one thing that occurred to me is that the trio, their master and the fair lady, it could actually be Eumenides and Delia, could be the master and the fair lady, in which case this whole play could turn into some great big glorious circular exercise in metatheatre. But I do feel that would be a fun exercise to do with a cast, particularly on this play, because they could take it off, you know, in any direction they like. The only limit is their imaginations.
The old wives' house, inside it has a little house.
Yes.
Inside it, which has a little house. And we have a sort of recursive occlusion going on, and everyone gets circularised in a meta way. I like that. You can do that in film very nicely. Alexandra, any specific rehearsal processes in mind?
Yes. So the performance process for me would involve these transitions from as Sarah was just talking about, you know, transitions from one environment, one part of the world into the next fairy tale, the next story, that I think would be mediated through things like who is being the voice of what sign expressed character and the reverse. So those things would need to be worked out in as part of the rehearsal process in an interesting way so as to facilitate those transitions. So that, for example, Antic at the beginning would be expressing himself through sign, whereas either Frolic or Fantastic would be doing his voice as well as their own. And then Antic goes away momentarily with Clunch and comes back as one of the brothers, whereas Frolic and Fantastic are listening to the story, except Antic's character is signing. Frolic, let's say, who has been his voice, is now sort of the only person in the room translating for the listeners what second brother is saying, and then gets roped into the story as a consequence of that. And, you know, similarly, so do the others eventually through this process. So that would be something that would be worked out in rehearsal. And also these quick changes and sudden transitions, because you've got a very small cast and some of them have to, you know, disappear, come back as someone else, disappear again, come back as the last person. I think that would be the main focus of what the rehearsal process would need to work out, rather than prescribing it ahead of time.
Yeah, I mean, it's for my production, because it would be part of a process where it would be a lot of it would be happening on the hoof. It would be something that's popping up in the middle of a festival when everybody else has got other jobs on. The script would be highly curated and presented. So everything would be done very intensely, everything very quickly. Luckily, because we won't be worrying about physical blocking, we could be primarily worrying about timing, but also where we... The one element that we would spend a lot of time on is any updating, playing around, or areas where comics are invited to improv. You know, those would be clearly demarcated elements. A certain level of chaos is going to be invited. However,
as we are currently illustrating.
Yeah, exactly. You know, things move at different paces.
Rehearsals could be done virtually. And at a pinch, you could also do virtual auditions. You know, normally the kind of audition I would love to do is the kind of audition where you have a lot of people in the room at one time. And people can feed off each other and you can see what different combinations look like. But in terms of rehearsal time, there are a couple of bits that I would like to film in advance and have those cued by the tech person. So those would take, I guess, a few days each to film, allowing for setbacks and disasters. I'd need a little time to do some text work, especially with Kwanebango, because that text is so surreal, it's important that it be internalized and that it be good. But really, you know, I'm a text coach. That's what I am in real life, so I'm completely up for doing text work with as many people and as much as we have time for. One thing that I learned from another company who did a very, very good Zoom production, a company based in San Francisco, they had a very high level of tech, probably more than what, you know, more than I'd even know how to work with, but they said that it took much more rehearsal time than it would have if they'd simply been going on stage. Mm. And a lot of that would be down to tech. Even though I'm doing less tech than they are, I would just say, you cast 8 weeks from opening and have 3 weeks of rehearsal and spend the rest of the time meeting with your text person to sort out tech and design and doing text work up front individually. And then 3 weeks of staging rehearsal, a couple workshop days in advance, 3 weeks of staging rehearsals and on.
Luxury. Luxury.
Yeah. I was thinking that is luxury.
Three weeks. You're lucky if you get a weekend.
First of all, this is fantasy. And second of all, if a thing is worth doing, it's worth being awesome.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Besides, I don't know how you intend to get stand-up comedians to A, speak early modern text, and B, take direction.
I'm going to refer you to the documentary Richard Osman's House of Games. You'll see there the stand-up comedians consistently are always the ones who are the sharpest and the quickest. And actually, I think you do them a slight disservice. I think they'd actually deal with the text incredibly well. In fact, uh-huh. Possibly a better position than others. It's the ego managing. That's going to be the problem. That's absolutely going to be the problem.
Proof of the pudding is in the eating, as we say. And yeah. I'd like to state for the record that I'd really like a pudding right now.
And it
like
should be a Madge's homemade pudding.
Yeah, absolutely. Thunk, thunk. And now a little interlude as we enter the chat room. Enter the chat room. We've already looked at this wonderful play twice on YouTube in our various exploring sessions, where we use the chat room to enter into the deeper world of the play and look for the more intellectual aspects that we can share and celebrate with you now. And so, as we enter the chat room, we're going to find out what the deepest and most intelligent thinkers of the world think about this play as they read it. So now, join us as we enter the chat room. Enter the chat room.
My world!
Perry cute!
Oh, my precious world!
Perry cute!
Oh, hey, Lady!
Muted! Crow!
Lady Hawk!
I think Robert should wear his hair like this every day.
Doggy!
And that was the important message from the chat room. We'll now leave the chat room and return you to your regular content. Question number six. Liza, script, changes, cuts, issues. The general question is, adapt or not?
You know, I greet that question with an enthusiastic hell yes. A lot of this play is going to be about clowning, and while clowns are famous for doing their own thing, my litmus test, as previously stated, is going to be, is it fun? I may or may not have a pre-vandalized version of the script with suggested cuts and additions on my computer right now. This is only a working version, and what I'd really be looking for is random stuff that happens in the room that we can just go, yeah, keep that. But hell yes. I would say, as a text person, if you cut, understand things before you cut them and understand what they are for, and don't cut anything that the rest of the story depends on, or if you do, know what to replace it with. But with understanding and love, hell yeah, cut.
Sarah, cut or die.
Yes, I'm very much of Liza's persuasion here. I mean, I worked as an editor for 15 years before I retrained as an actor, so I'm very much into the editing. And
it isn't a very long play, Sarah.
It's not necessarily, you don't necessarily have to cut bits out. You might even want to add bits in. I have to say, as someone who writes her own scripts and has adapted quite a few existing scripts for various productions, I am the sort of person who plays quite fast and loose with a script. But with the proviso of absolutely what Liza just said, you have to know what you're doing. You have to know why something is there, so that if you change it or adapt it or extend it or cut it, you know what effect you're going to have, because it's like dominoes. But in general, yeah, I would say adapt. And let's face it, if I'm doing a Hollywood version, I'm going to have to adapt it anyway.
Alexandra, adapt or die.
If you're doing a Hollywood version, it's going to be adapted on you.
Yeah, I'm not going to have any choice. Someone else is going to... I'm going to come up with this great script and then someone else is going to take it away and ruin it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think I agree with both of you on the idea that you need to try to make it work the way it is before you decide that you want to make changes. And also, you can edit things in more ways than just take them out or put them in. So one of the things that I think would come out in rehearsal in my production is that there would be lines that need to be reassigned. So that someone else says the thing, or it goes in a different part of the text so as to facilitate changes, or by which I mean kind of doubling or jokes or what have you. I also think that there's a lot of humor that is quite dirty in this, that one might want to adjust around depending on what your intended audience is. I don't think a lot of it would need to be cut for if you wanted to do this with like a family audience, as it were. I don't think that stuff should be taken out. It's about how you play it rather than what the words are. But I do think there might be a couple of sensitivity adjustments that would need to be made, again, in my production, around the there's a couple of interactions with the magic head, or actually not with it, but around those scenes where what seems to be happening is, yes, is simultaneously there are sex jokes, but also there is some humor that seems to be happening at the expense of the flaws of the people involved. It's fun if we're laughing with someone, you know, referring to their disability or appearance or what have you. It's not fun if we're laughing at them or if someone else is abusing that feature. So those particular very, very specific details, but they're very few.
I'm also quite interested about adding in people stepping out of character. So to quote Liza from one of our sessions, the ending is very bros before hoes, and it's not commented on because it's sort of this ridiculous ending of hey, you promised I would like to have half of your lady. Okay, then I made a promise. Let's chop her in half, and she just goes, yeah, that's fine with me. And I just kind of want the character to just say what. Or something like that, and play around with that, because the play invites that kind of conversation.
Mm.
So, and with the kind of casting that I'm doing, that kind of address could be very fun and engaging. Problem is keeping it down, keeping it short. Okay, super fast one, this one. Any favourite... question number 7, Alexandra. Any favourite lines, speeches, scenes or characters? Anything you really want to flag up?
Yes, I really like the way in which Juanibango and also Madge are conveyed through the language, the way in which they use language. Of course, this would be the use of vocal language. I think also sign language would be definitory for other characters in an interesting way. And I wanted to quote the Latin interaction between Juanibango and Booby. So Juanibango says, meus, mea, meum, in contemptum omnium grammaticorum. He's referring to a woman and she's mine, in contempt of all grammar. And Booby responds, O falsum Latinum, the fair maid is minum, cum appurtenantibus jubletis and all. I don't feel like that needs translating. So yes, that's a favourite line.
My favourite line comes early in the play. It's Madge. When her listeners start asking her too many questions, she says, Nay, either hear my tale or kiss my tale.
Sarah, have you got any lines you love?
Yeah, that was one of mine as well, so I'm glad I picked more than one.
I'm feeling this is definitely going on a mug.
Yes, I feel it is, yeah.
The image, I haven't created any images for this yet, but that's one where the images in my mind are getting quite fun.
Yeah. Frolic has a great line, which I really love. We are like to wander with a sorrowful hi-ho among the owlets and hobgoblins of the forest. I do like a good creepy fairy tale line. And then my other one is from Salanta. She's talking about her sister, the amazing Xantippe, and she says, the veriest vixen that lives upon God's earth. And I definitely want that emblazoned across a T-shirt.
Lovely. Well, I'm going to throw it, unless anyone else has got any. Oh, blessed Smith, oh, bountiful Clunch. I particularly like the line Clunch says, Hark, this is Ball, my dog, that bids you all welcome in his own language.
Okay, we get the final question of the session, and probably about time too. So this is, what's your one-line pitch? And this is either if you're putting it into a pitch meeting, or for that matter, what kind of taglines you want to put on a poster. So for the pitch meeting, I've gone for, it's Jack and Nori meets Panto meets Live at the Apollo, which I think, you know, sums it up reasonably well. For a very British audience there, I should point out, you know, those around the world won't necessarily know much about Panto or Live at the Apollo. For a film poster, I've gone for a selection of quotes. Who are you going to call? Juanibango. Thought that one worked quite nicely. Message incoming from the big giant head. I thought that might work quite nicely as a callback to the late 90s there. And finally, we've got head, so we'll give head.
Oh, classy.
Yeah. I think you've got the level that I'm aiming for here.
Yeah.
It's very intellectual, very, very, very heavy there. Liza, any? What's your one-line pitch?
Liza's just so appalled she can't even speak.
Oh, it takes more than that to render me speechless. It's just that not all the words I have are suitable for family consumption.
I think we're past that point by now.
So my one-line pitch is all the fairy tales, all the time, and bread and cheese. I should probably also come up with something for the whole Ghost of Jack storyline, which is so delightful. A man randomly stumbles across friends mourning over a corpse which they can't afford to bury, and he pays for the burial. And then a mysteriously helpful person with the same name as the person he just paid to bury turns up, and woo, and that person helps him for the rest of the play. So, you know, a friendly ghost. Yeah, bread. Every fairy tale happens at once, plus bread and cheese and a friendly ghost.
My one-line pitch, well, given that this is meant to be a big blockbuster Hollywood film, my one-line tag is the old wives. You have to have the, you know, that voice that they always use in trailers for Hollywood.
Old wives tale.
Yes, exactly.
In a world where wives are old.
Yes, exactly. So have that voice in your head. The pitch is the old wives tale when cheese shapes your destiny.
Yeah, Yeah, that's okay, that's the trailer we're making. With the sort of dun 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 kind of music in the background.
One man dared to become a bear.
Alexandra, one line pitches.
Yes, I was considering Four Tales, Three Weddings and Two Funerals, but I feel as though that's directly. So I think I'm going to go with one of yours. I think I might go with All the Tales All the Time or something of that nature. That feels so much better.
So those are our general pitches. Which do you like? Which do you prefer? By all means, get in touch. And that's what we want. This is want to be a bit more of a two-way street with the podcast and the patrons. A bit more discussion about where we go from here, especially if you want one of these productions to come into being. At the moment, the most plausible to actually come into a reality is Liza's. And we are sort of quietly working in the background to move in that general direction of making that happen. So that's where any money you send might go first. I think we'd have to wait a long time if it went to Sarah. A very, very long time. But we are working in that general direction. So questions for you is, do you have any questions for us? I came up with 8 questions to sort of prompt the room. But are there any questions you think we should be asking about our fantasy productions? What plays do you want to see done in this fashion next? On the YouTube channel, we go through each of these plays at least twice, ideally, before we do this setup. So at the moment, there's only about 4 plays you can choose from, but that is increasing as we go forward. We may, at absolute extremis, go back to one we've only looked at once. We won't look at something that people can't at least look at in some way on some video form online. It's important that you can listen to this randomly if you want to, or you can do it within the context of having some idea what the hell we're talking about. We make a token stab to explain as we go, but we're not trying too hard. Also, guests. We'd like some guests. This room is what you've got at the moment, but some of us won't be here all the time. We want to ebb and flow, and we want different people to come in. So if you'd like to be a guest, it could be you. If you want to read and be involved in any of these play online Zoom sessions, they're open to all. There is a sign up. There are links in the show notes. Go to the website beyondshakespeare.org. You will find there is a page exploring in isolation where you can sign up every single week.
Please come read with us. It is fun.
Yes, really selling it there. Really selling it there. We are not a cult.
Listen to what Rob says. Rob is right.
That's the affirmations I play to myself every night. If you have any feedback or thought, answers on a postcard, email us at admin@beyondshakespeare.org, or you can follow us online, various platforms, at Beyond Shakes on Twitter, Facebook or Instagram, at Beyond Shakes pretty much for everything. That's our general universal. Yes, or you can become a patron, give us a pledge of as little as £1 a month or $1 a month or whichever local currency you have a month, and you will get some access to what's going on. And the more you give, the more access and the more stuff you get, along with watching us being lovely and getting all the stuff that we cut out of this audio, probably including this bit, actually. I might re-record this bit separately later.
I'm thinking that's a good idea. Yeah.
So, without further ado, all that remains is to say farewell, Sarah.
Farewell.
Farewell from Alexandra.
Thank you and goodbye.
And farewell from Liza.
So long, farewell, auf Wiedersehen, adieu.
And it's farewell from myself. I'm Robert Crichton, your host and general overseer of all the things. Goodbye.
In a world where wives are old.
Nay, either hear my tale or kiss my tale.
We are like to wander with a sorrowful hi-ho among the owlets and hobgoblins of the forest.
One man dared to become a bear.
Bountiful clunch.
The old wives' tale, when cheese shapes your destiny.
Come read with us. It is fun.